Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way Sundays, that's right, Sunday mornings and evenings at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday morning at 1 a.m., and then we stream the broadcast at richarddugan.com. The radio show's page is where we archive the pages, if you will, the interviews, and we also link to our guests, and we'll be giving you that information here shortly as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, as we are working towards our 10th year celebration here on Tell Me Your Story, and we're very happy that you are able to join us here, hopefully on a regular basis, to hear what our guests have to say, have what they have to offer, and hopefully help you out as well. I think you're going to enjoy today's program, as I always enjoy these broadcasts and look forward to having our guests on the program and just really getting an insight, not only into their world, but into even my world. I mean, our guests tend to open up doors that, you know, we didn't even think were there, or windows that have been closed for a long, long time. So I encourage you to stay with us here on the program and be enlightened and inspired. My guest today is the author of a trilogy, of which the first book we're going to talk about, and it's a rather interesting and intriguing title as well, but it's called Dear Human, Master Your Emotions. This is volume one of the Inner Mastery series, and Mark Youngblood is my guest. Mark, thank you so much for joining us all the way from Florida, Sarasota, Florida, via Skype.
Thank you, Richard. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, this is an interesting aspect to our conversations that we've been having over the course of time with many of our guests, dealing with emotion, dealing with that whole aspect of part of who and what we are. It's not something to escape or to shut down, but it's something that we need to understand and learn how to I don't even want to use the word cope, but learn how to live with our emotions, and maybe, I guess, get control of them. Is that, based upon the title of your book, after all, Master Your Emotions, is that even possible?
Well, we're not trying to control them so much, and I think that you did start to point to that, as it is to have a relationship with them where it's an integral part of us, and these emotions are assets, they're resources, and they're here to help us out. And we were never taught how to deal with them. We didn't come with a user manual. We were just born with this suite of emotions, and we've been left on our own to figure out what do we do with them. And for the most part, we handle them pretty poorly. I have a bold statement that I make, is that the vast majority of the suffering and of the conflict we experience in society is due to our inability to handle our painful emotions. And that if we can and we could handle those emotions effectively or process them effectively, it would transform everyone's lives individually and throughout society. And that's one of the primary motivators for writing this book and also the subsequent books in the series.
Well, now, the first person I think of, and honestly, in the years that I have known this person, we collectively as a society have known this person, this character, first person I think of is Spock. And the reason I say that he didn't really quite master his emotions, because they leaked out every so often, you know?
No, actually, Spock didn't master his emotions so much as, well, you know, that whole, you know, his species didn't feel them. And this is not about not feeling your emotions. It's actually about feeling them and using them in an effective way. What typically happens is that if it's painful, we react to it in a way to avoid experiencing that painful emotion. And there's a number of things that we do that don't work very well, either for us or for the people and society around us. And what we want to be able to do is to handle them in a healthy way, so we don't act them out, but we also aren't suppressing them, we're not numbing them, we're not displacing them, and all the various ways that we as humans seek to not feel those emotions.
And of course, for you and I, as males growing up, I'm sure that I am not sure. I know that I never really heard that phrase, you know, that boys don't cry, that kind of thing. But I don't know that it was necessarily encouraged to be emotional. Now, when I got mad and started to express that in whatever fashions, I was told, "Hey, what do you think you're doing?" So I guess that that's the sort of the rock and the hard place kind of situation from one standpoint, that you don't want to suppress them, but then at the same time, you don't want to go all the way to the other extreme and just are constantly, you know, emoting when certain things happen in our lives. I mean, I take a look at our most recent political situation, and people who, you know, and again, it doesn't matter which side you're on or what position you take, people are upset and they're out there in the streets and they're protesting. And I just sit there going, what is this accomplishing? That's my perspective. And I'm not asking you necessarily to address that specifically, but more to address the issue of those kinds of reactions, if you will.
Well, you know, you started to point something out, Richard, and I'll even interview you here a little bit and ask for some of your experience, because you, to some extent, you're going to be representative of what other people have had to deal with. We're born with these emotions, and we get the entire suite. It's the whole palette of colorful emotions, from anger to joy to happiness to shame, frustration. You could go all the way down the list. And babies don't have any hesitation expressing any of them. But there comes a point where we start to get taught about what's good and bad, what's right and wrong. And you and I, as males growing up in this particular society, there's a strong message about expressing what many would consider to be the weak emotions. And was there a point when you were growing up as a male where you clearly got the message that crying was a bad thing?
You know, I don't think that I did at home from family. Think that I probably got that more from my, I use the term loosely, my peers growing up in school, because I was one of those who, you know, I had to deal with the bullies. And certainly the last thing you wanted to do was show any kind of vulnerability. As a matter of fact, I went the other direction. I would get angry until I was able in a late grade school in physical ed. I became involved with track and field, so I learned to run. And that was my escape. But before that, I was angry, not so much crying. And there was no way I was going to show them that I was upset by crying in front of them, because, my God, that would give them more ammunition.
Exactly. And what you're now profiling is your unique experience of learning what is okay and not okay in terms of emotions and what's acceptable to express. And we get all these complicated rules, and we try to live within these rules. Well, I grew up in a household where if I got hurt, my father didn't want me crying. And he would tell me, if you keep crying, I'll give you a good reason, which meant getting a beating. And so I was taught not to cry. And as much work as I've done on myself and my own personal self-development and spiritual growth, I still struggle to cry in front of somebody else, because that prohibition is so deep. And everyone gets messages like that, where we're either taught emotions are good or bad, and so we try to live within these arbitrary rules that thwart the way we're wired to be as human beings. Or we develop our own rules because an emotion is painful. So anger is the emotion you use to displace the real emotion that you wanted to have at that moment. Because it wasn't okay to just cry. You had to displace it and not actually fulfill what was trying to be expressed with something else, which looked strong in your particular case. Now, if this interview was happening with a woman, I could be asking her, what were you told was acceptable and unacceptable? And we're actually seeing this dialogue play out in the larger social context right now, where women are reclaiming their power. They're reclaiming the right to be treated equally. Whereas as an executive coach, I work with high-powered executives all the time, male and female. And a male executive, a lot of times frustration and anger and impatience, that's seen as a strong leader. You know, that person's letting their will be known and getting people in line. And a woman does the same thing, and guess what she's called?
I can't think
An
of the word.
An unpleasant word.
Yes. Okay, I hear what you're saying. It starts with a B, I believe.
It does. It does. You know, and plus she's called bossy and pushy and intolerant. She just gets labeled in ways that a man doing it would not, because we have these arbitrary standards around emotions that then make it really unhealthy for the person who's not processing their emotions in a healthy way, and also for all the interactions, because they're not able to do it in the most appropriate way for the situation.
Yeah.
So we need to really untangle all of this and start to come to terms with emotions are just emotions. They're not good. They're not bad. There are no negative emotions. There are emotions that are mishandled, and there are emotions that are handled effectively, and that's all there is to it. And so every emotion has a role. Every emotion has a purpose, and emotions are messengers.
Well, I tell you, this whole aspect of emotions, and certainly people have been feeling very specific ones over the last year and a half, 2 years, even going on 3 years here, because they don't care much for the way things have been going, are going, or are going to be going. And it's like, well, that's nothing new, but it just seems like, you know, people are more at odds. And again, they're expressing their out of sortsness, if you will, their angst, in ways in which I sit there and ask myself, you know, how productive is this? I mean, I have, I'm upset too over certain things, but, you know, I just don't have the desire or drive to go out there and and participate in the same activities that a lot of the other folks are doing, because I don't see that there's an ends to the means that justifies the means. Mm-hmm. And so I think the other aspect, too, in terms of emoting, and I'm kind of with you even to this day as far as crying in front of other people. Now, if I'm with a group of people and we're watching, say, a movie, or we're watching a particular event that's very, very emotional, very profound, sure. I mean, you're going to see a tear roll down my eye, but am I going to stand there bawling? Probably not.
Right.
But I think the other part of it, too, is because you even use the word shame. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the problem that, again, was more inculcated from society than from family, is that I don't want to show, because I don't know what kind of reaction I'm going to get. Am I going to be criticized for emoting like this, or am I going to be, in a manner of speaking, praised? Oh, how wonderful that, you know, you're really, you know, you're into this, you're really feeling this, and so am I. And, you know, in other words, a shared cathartic event, if you will. But that's just one of, I don't know, dozens of a dozen or more emotions that we go through. And it's usually a combination. I've heard it said that when you're asked, how are you feeling, and you tell them and you list only one item, you haven't told the whole truth. There's another emotion that's going on, at least one other at the same time. And I remember the example that was given. For example, you go on vacation with the family, you go to Disneyland, and you come home, and, hey, how was your vacation? Oh, it was great. It was fantastic. It was this. It was that. But if you were really honest, it was great and it was awful at the same time. You know, and again, you could go through a list of the things that went wrong. I mean, I even look at my vacation that my wife and I took up to Yosemite and then to Nevada City here in California for a week. We drove up and had a great time, made sure that we had no timetable and deadlines that we had to meet. So we just took our time. But yet there was the traffic that we had to deal with. But instead of getting all bent out of shape, we sort of renegotiated our path. We got off the freeway. No more congestion. Now it's stress-free and we're having a great time. Taking a little longer. That's okay. We're not on any, you know. So, and I'm wondering if that is something that is true in terms of how we're feeling when you ask somebody in practice. So how are you feeling?
Well, most certainly. It's you pointed out a couple of different things that tie together. It's that question, how are you feeling? And we're feeling a complex set of emotions at any point in time. And you also talked about this last year and a half, how people have acted out their outrage and getting into the streets. Both of those have something in common, and that is that often what we're displaying is not the real emotion. There's five ways that people avoid painful emotions. One of them is to suppress them. A second is drama. A third is addiction. A fourth is compulsions. And a fifth is suicide, that I would rather die than feel these painful emotions. Now, I'm not trivializing suicide. I know that mental health is an issue. Mental illness is an issue with that. And yet it's one of the primary factors that goes into something that extreme in order to avoid painful emotions. So let's just talk about one of those. Let's talk about drama. And drama is anytime we have an emotional reaction, anytime we're triggered by our external environment. And often, like with the anger you spoke about for yourself, or that outrage and in the streets, you know, people shouting their frustration and anger, that's not the real emotion. The real emotion they're feeling is underneath that. And it's what I call a black sheep emotion. And I call it black sheep because it's an emotion we don't want to cope with. We don't want to feel it. We don't want to deal with it. And there's a few common black sheep emotions that most people have. Now, yours are unique to you. Mine are unique to me. But most people have shame, fear, sadness, grief as their primary black sheep emotions and don't want to feel them. So when someone is angry and shouting, what they're really feeling is probably fear. What they're really feeling is grief over the loss of something that's really important to them, fear that bad things and things that are going to hurt them. But they're not turning within and dealing with those feelings in a healthy way so that they can choose productive actions that don't require drama, that doesn't require all that acting out. And you can see it doesn't matter what social context you're talking about, whether it's at work and you're dealing with stress or you're dealing with a jerk of a boss or a lazy coworker that's not pulling their weight, or with your husband or wife and they are being insensitive to you or dumping the majority of the workload on you. What we tend to act out in as drama are the energies that project outward. They're frustration, anger, impatience, resentment, bitterness, hurt, feeling hurt, and those kinds of things. But what we're really feeling is inside one of those black sheep emotions, and we're just not dealing with that black sheep emotion.
I have to wonder, too, if maybe one of the black sheep emotions, I'm not even sure what the definition would be or the actual word, maybe you can help me, with people out there protesting and carrying on and so forth, is maybe in the background they're saying to themselves, what didn't I do to change the outcome or to make things better and so on and so forth, or to prevent this kind of a scenario from unfolding? You know, sort of a self-deprecating, if you will, a feeling. Because I remember conversations that I've had with people, and they're just railing against whatever other side they're railing against. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking with one gentleman, and I says, "Did you ever? First of all," and this was he was a host of a program that leaned one particular direction. And I says, two things. One is, did you ever think maybe that you owe the other side a debt of gratitude for their existence? Because if they weren't there, you'd have nothing to talk about. And number two, I mean, think about that. I mean, if they weren't there. And I have to tell you that both sides of a situation like what we're dealing with in this country these days almost wish the other side would just disappear and then everything would just be perfect. And first of all, that isn't going to happen. And even if it did, it wouldn't make things perfect. I mean, how'd you like to live in a world where everybody agreed with you? Where's the, and I'm not talking about drama here. I'm talking about just having some kind of a conversation.
Well, what you have to get down to is what is the anatomy of an emotional reaction? And the one you're talking about is, I despise what you have to say so much, I don't want you to even exist. That's kind of what you're pointing at. Mm-hmm. And so we have to look at the anatomy of a reaction. And a reaction is anytime the world doesn't conform to what I want. Now, Richard, you might go, but that sounds like a two-year-old. And I don't know if you have children, but I'm sure you've seen children that at 2 years old are pitching a fit because they're not getting their way.
Don't put down 2 years old, 2 year olds.
And that really is still the same dynamic that we experience as adults. When the world doesn't conform to what we want, we tend to go into a reaction, as if somehow the world owes us the responsibility to be a certain way. And it doesn't. Now, you and I, being rational, reasonable people, we know the world's not going to conform to what we want. Mm-hmm. It's just not. Every single day, there's going to be things that line up and lots of things that do not line up. The traffic won't be what you wanted. The weather won't be. Your kids won't be ready on time. The person across the hall didn't get the report to you in time that you needed it, on and on and on and on and on. So the question we have to ask is, since life isn't going to conform to what we want, and there's going to be an infinite number of reasons to get upset, do you still want to keep getting upset?
Yeah.
Or do you want to find a way to navigate yourself through a life, through the world that is just going to be the way it is, and be able to stay calm and clear and joyful and navigate that life without blowing up, without having trigger after trigger after trigger. And when you can do that, what I have found, and the people that use the tools in this book have found as well, is you can be your best self. Because we basically are our best self. When everything's going our way, we're pretty great to be around. And that's true of almost everybody. When things are going our way, it's great. It's when it doesn't go our way that we go into reaction and then we start to demonstrate some of our less desirable qualities. But it doesn't have to be that way, because we have the power to take charge of what happens inside of us. And that's the process I've been calling inner mastery, is that we can have dominion over our internal experiences. So that by the time they show up for the outside world, they're the kind of expression of who we really want to be, of who we want the world to see us as. And Richard, you've interviewed a ton of people. I went out and looked at the interviews you did. I just marvel at the experiences you must have had. And, you know, so you've talked with lots and lots of amazing people. And in my experience, though, everyone is amazing. Everyone has the potential to be a truly extraordinary human being when they are able to manage what's happening inside them so they can cope with a difficult world and still be their best self. That's when they can achieve it.
Yeah. Well, the second point I would make to someone in that regard, that conversation, was also and maybe this was a little unfair of me to put it in this context, but at the time it seemed logical to me. Don't you think that you're partly responsible for that which you think you're all upset about because of what they did, because you didn't do enough to get the people you wanted in those offices so that none of this would have happened? You know, and of course, the look I got was, you're a fool, you're an idiot, and I'm going to go in there and do my show. But the reality for me is that there's only so much we can do. And in many cases, you know what? There's nothing I can do, and I need to somehow change my perspective. You actually have, and I had to chuckle when I saw this. You have one of your chapter titles. I was actually, when I read it, I thought, wait a minute, did I read that right? And I'm thinking, okay, he's got a chapter in here called Drain the Swamp. Oh, not really. It's not Drain the Swamp. It's called Drain the Pain. But you could say that where the pain resides could be a swamp. So we drain that, we deal with the pain, and we move on. From upset to calm in 60 seconds. Now,
right.
Okay, Mark, come on. Let's get real. 60 seconds? Is that really? That's all it takes?
Well, it may take 30 seconds. It may take, you know, 90 seconds, but it's about that. Yeah, it is. When you know the tools to work with your subconscious, and by the way, I sure wish you would have talked to me before I finished naming that technique, because I think Drain the Swamp is a way better. It's a way better name, because it is a swamp, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just this kind of messy, stinky thing that happens. And well, let me explain what that's about. Emotional pain, we flinch away from it. Just the same way if someone were to jab you with something sharp, you would flinch away from that. And we do the same thing emotionally. So almost everybody, once they become an adult, as they start to have an emotion, they also begin to suppress it. And suppressing emotions is one of the main things that we do to not feel them. And it's part of why we also then do other displacing behaviors like addictions and cutting and bulimia and things like that. But these suppressed emotions, they're bottled up. They haven't gone away. Earlier on, I mentioned that emotions are like messengers. They show up, they tap you on the shoulder, and they say, I've got a delivery of two things. One of them is energy and the other is information. And so anger, for instance, anger shows up and it brings you this uprising energy. It's an activating energy. And the message of how to use it is someone has crossed a boundary that is not okay with you. Use this energy to hold your boundary. And that's the purpose of anger, is to hold boundaries. So if I don't allow myself to experience anger, and many, many people were taught anger is bad, then I will shove it down. But that doesn't mean it went away. It doesn't go away until you process it. And once you suppress it and shut it down, it's like this pressure. And then you're not just sitting on one emotion, you're sitting on dozens at any point in time. So Richard, imagine being at the beach. I live near a beach and see this frequently, and you've got a beach ball and you're trying to shove this beach ball down under the water. Well, it takes a huge amount of energy and it's a constant effort to keep that beach ball under the water. And that's what we're doing with these emotions. But if we could somehow deflate that beach ball and let all the air out, then it would be really easy to push that, to cope with it, because the thing that was keep making it hard was gone. And that's what we want to do with these suppressed emotions. They're still there, but we can drain them out using techniques that work with the subconscious through a particular visualization that communicates to your subconscious through the autonomic nervous system to tell it, go ahead and let that emotion go, drain it out. And when you do, it's literally like you're draining a big container that is full and under pressure, and it's full of this energy. And as you drain it out, you're left light and relaxed and feeling really great. And it takes about 60 seconds,
you know,
for most people to be able to do it.
I have to share this example because this isn't just about dealing with other people. It's dealing with inanimate objects as well. My wife and I, we all can relate, especially the guys can relate to this. I was building, I was actually adding some trim to our chicken coop. Went out, we bought the molding, cut it, and I had these little nails that for whatever reason, I still don't know why, they had been painted white, so some of them were still stuck together. Now, I didn't paint them, mind you. I bought them this way. Obviously, there's a reason why they painted them white. Anyway, every time I would drive one of these tiny little finishing nails into the wood, the nail would bend. Now, what is going on here, you know? And now, these are small moldings, so if I use larger nails, it's going to split the wood. So I got three of the four corners covered. And the fourth corner, I must have gone through 5 or 6 or 7 nails, and I was really getting steamed because this project should be, I should be done and in the house now. And I got so angry that I took the hammer and I destroyed the molding. Okay? I destroyed the molding while it was on the side of the coop, which, you know, not a good thing because I could damage the coop and I don't have materials necessarily to replace. But fortunately, I had cut cuttings from the other, from the four themselves, because they were longer than they needed to be, so I had to trim them down. So I had enough of these cuttings. I was able to take 3 of the 4 cuttings, put them together. They actually came out to the exact length. So I said, okay, you know, this is what you should have done with all 4 of these in the first place. Drill a hole in each of these in the strategic places. Go ahead and use the larger nails that will not damage the coop, but will easily go through the molding and not split it. And then you're done. So I painted them. I drilled the holes, then I painted them, waited for it to dry, put them up, 5 minutes, I was done. Hmm. Now, they say necessity is the mother of invention. Now, I could have done that with all 4 of those standard length molding strips, and I would have been done in 5 minutes. Hmm. And what I'm getting to is this. I had that idea before any of this started, and I didn't listen. Hmm. Intuition. What role does that play when you're talking about this whole mastery, mastering of emotions?
Hmm. Well, that is an interesting question. It's the first time I've been asked that question. It, to me, intuition is a topic all by itself compared to being able to understand, notice, and process through a healthy emotion. The intuition you're talking about, if you had followed that, then you would have been able to go through a much more efficient process and avoided the mistakes that you made. And I think we all have access to our intuition, learning to quiet ourselves and listen to that intuition. There definitely is a relationship between being able to hear our intuition. You heard yours. You knew it was there. Most people can't. And emotions are a culprit in part in not being able to hear our intuition, because stress, emotional reactions cause a lot of mind chatter. And Richard, with all the people you've interviewed and the man I know you to be, I know that you are aware of the importance of mindfulness and the importance of a quiet mind. And when you have a quiet mind, intuition goes way up. It's like a whisper in a rock concert. And if you don't turn the volume down, you're not going to hear that whisper. And so part of the tools of mindfulness, of managing your emotions, is mindfulness. It's the base level. Level 1 of emotional mastery is the ability to create calmness and generally across your nervous system. And that will also enhance the intuition. Now, did you feel any guilt? Did you feel any self-recrimination about why didn't I follow my guidance? Why didn't I just do this right to start with? Was that any part of the dialogue?
Actually, the dialogue was, okay, do not say anything to your wife about what just transpired. Just let her know that it all went together just fine. Or, and this is what I did tell her, or tell her that as you were hammering the nail, it just split the wood, and so here's your new plan B. Okay? You don't go into, oh, yeah, I got really pissed off. I got angry, and I started taking it out with the hammer on the molding.
Yeah, yeah. So, right. So what is the emotion you were feeling when you wanted to avoid telling your wife what it was that you did?
I think it was shame over getting angry and being, you know, and she's not really that critical, but still, even the smallest, and I know she goes through the same thing when she does something and she's got to tell me, and she doesn't really want to tell me because she's afraid that I'm going to criticize her and really put her down, which I would never do. But that's there for both of us. So, yeah.
Exactly. So in that circumstance, then, so instead of just walking in and being able to say, you know what? I just made a mess of things. I just beat this thing to bits. I got so frustrated with it. And, you know, I just wish I could have done that differently. You didn't do that because it was too painful to admit that yeah. to somebody whose opinion is really important to you. Mm. That's a perfect example of displacing what the real issue is. Now, and we're not perfect in our marriage by any stretch, but my wife and I practice everything that is in this book and that I teach with regard to inner mastery. And we're at a point where we would walk in and go, you know what? I really lost it. And I just smashed this thing and I was in a story and I just got fed up with it. And I'm feeling pretty bad about it. And the other one just hears it like, okay, well, you're a human being. Instead of, well, you jerk. what's wrong with you? And this is part of what I'm saying is that we can get to a place as human beings where it transforms the way we deal with anything. Like when you started feeling yourself getting frustrated, there's a technique in the book. You would have seen a chapter called Max the Moment.
Yes.
And Max the Moment, it says, this is about in the moment of an upset, how do you maximize your productive response to it instead of your emotional reaction to it? And the first step of that is to tame it. And tame it says, notice you're reacting. So just as soon as you start to get frustrated, and boy, Richard, I was grinning from ear to ear because I know that feeling so well. That's why my favorite tool is a checkbook. I would much rather somebody else be dealing with it than me. But the way this is designed to work is that you notice, oh, I'm getting frustrated here. This isn't working the way I want to. And that's the message of frustration. It's telling you, hey, what you're doing isn't working. Stop, back up, and do something different. And instead, we typically act out that frustration on the object instead of owning that we're the cause of this.
Yeah.
And if you could, and going through that technique, you would have stopped. You'd have noticed that you're in reaction. There's a part of it where you stop. You would have drained that frustration. You would have noticed where it is in your body, and you'd have done the technique. And by the way, listeners can download that particular chapter for free off my website, and they can have that technique for themselves. And you would have drained it out mm-hmm. down into the ground, and you would have felt clearer, and you would have said, okay, I'm in a drama here because this thing isn't doing what I want it to do. And that's the name it part. And you'd have gotten clear about what story you were in that was working you up. And then you would have gone to reframe it. And reframe it is, okay, what do I really want here? What do I really want to do? And that's where you bring the productive response. And that's where you got to. With these techniques, you could have avoided all of the acting out. And that's just one example. And thank you for both the courage and vulnerability and being the person you are to share a personal story about like that. Because that's really everybody's story, Richard. And that was your unique expression of it. But we've all got our own stories like that.
Well, I will tell you that if my wife does listen to this particular program, now she's going to know. Or if someone who we know listens to this program and connects with her somehow and tells her, then she's going to know. So, you know, but I have to say that I had to give myself a little bit of credit after the fact that once I realized that I had just split that piece of wood, that molding, and kind of calmed down, I began to formulate Plan B. I began to say, okay, how do I fix this? How do I make this? Because this was our project, okay? Even though I was doing the majority of the heavy labor, this was a project that we were both invested in and vested in. Mm-hmm. And as I was, even as I was coming down off of the hammer high, and I'm looking at the aftermath, you know, I started thinking, okay, you can't go any further because if you ruin this, you ruin it for not just you, but for her too. And she's really going to, how are you going to feel if you disappoint her in that regard? Mm-hmm. So that was part of my stopping that anger train. And then again, formulating, all right, so how can I fix this? What do I need? And so then I'm trying to put the split pieces back together. There were only two. So you know, I thought, well, maybe I could glue it. I could do this. I could do that. I could do the other. And then I remembered the scraps. And the scraps actually went together so beautifully. Like I said, I should have done it with the other three around the other three corners. But hey, you know what? It's finished. It's done. It looks great. She loves it. Right. And we've moved forward. So, yeah, I think that, this whole process that you're talking about, I think, is extremely valuable for folks. And I would highly recommend checking this out. When we get back, Mark, I want to give out your website, contact information, and so forth as we continue our conversation with Mark Youngblood. And we are talking, of course, this is a neat little series here that we're starting out with. Dear Human, Master Your Emotions, Volume 1 of the Inner Mastery Series. We'll talk about what other subsequent volumes he's got coming out here shortly, and we'll do that when we get back here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Thanks for staying with us as we continue our conversation with Mark Youngblood and, of course, the Dear Human series, Mastering. Basically, we're talking about learning how to master your emotions. This is Volume 1 of the Inner Mastery series. You know, we're always looking for ways to master the outer world in terms of different things that we're doing. I would like to be a much better carpenter, and I'm getting there. I just have to, folks, you're going to have to listen to segment one to understand what I'm talking about. But I'm getting better in terms of knowing what tools to use. Just bought a brand new drill after the one that a buddy of mine gave me many, many years ago. Just finally broke down, and I just don't have the technical skills. I bet you if I sent it to my dad, even though he's in his 80s, he probably could fix it. It'll go in reverse. It won't go forward. In other words, it'll unscrew anything you want, but won't screw anything or drill anything in. So, interesting dilemma. But it's one of those areas where, yeah, I'd like to become a better craftsman in that regard and make things look really, really nice. But hey, you know, maybe that's not my aptitude. But I'm gonna keep trying and work at it. And again, when I mentioned in the first segment there, Mark, about intuition, listen, because if I have a situation where I would really like this thing to look nice, I'd like this to look really professional, like it was done by a craftsman, and I wouldn't disagree with pulling out the checkbook and having someone who has those aptitudes do it instead of me, and it would really look great. But I have to say that there's a certain level of satisfaction that I get out of doing these things. Whether, quite honestly, Mark, whether it's pulling out the fuel-powered weed whacker or chainsaw and going to town, and this is because of where we live in the wilderness above Santa Barbara, there's such a wonderful feeling when these kinds of things, they come together. And they just, it's almost like, it feels almost like a miracle. I had nothing to do with it. And it's, you know, but I did, obviously. But it just, it's like, oh, man, what if, I mean, I trimmed the, for the first time in like 6 or 7 years because of our drought, we actually have grass in our backyard, as I call it. The only reason it's our backyard is because I fenced in the area coming out the back door. If the fence wasn't there, it's just the wilderness, right? But the smell of the grass after it was cut, and it reminded me of my childhood growing up with my father. He'd go out there and he'd mow the lawn. And then, of course, for the rest of the day and the next couple of days, you just smell that wonderful fragrance of the chlorophyll in the air and the newly cut grass blades and so forth. And then, of course, just the look of it as well, and on and on and on. So I get, you know, that sense of satisfaction. I mean, it's a great feeling. I know that, you know, we've all felt that when we've completed a task. And, you know, I'm 16 years into writing my book, which is smaller than you. Yeah, go ahead. It's all right. I've made the commitment, though. I've made several commitments at the beginning of 2017 that I was going to accomplish. One of them was to take a vocal coaching a lesson, which I did. And then another one, of course, is to finish my book that is based upon my second wife's experience with being diagnosed with and being treated with surgery and chemotherapy for cancer. And then one of the other ones was to literally to pull everything out of my studio, clean the studio, rearrange it in such a way. I became the proud owner of a sound booth that I have in my studio, and wiring that up and getting all of that set up so that I have a more professional setting, and so forth. So, you know, those are kind of neat feelings as those are unfolding. But let me ask you, how do people get a hold of you and get more information about Volume 1 of this wonderful Inner Mastery series?
My website is www.myinnermastery.com, M-Y-Inner, I-N-N-E-R, Mastery, M-A-S-T-E-R-Y.com. And you can get all sorts of information out on the website, including three of the chapters from the book that are for free for you to download.
Now, this is just number one. This is number one.
Let's
just kind of touch upon two, three, and I mean, who knows how many more there will be. But as far as your plans, what are we looking forward to?
Well, let's talk about inner mastery. This is not a term most people have an experience of. And it's based on the idea that we create our world from the inside out, that literally every single thing that we produce in our environment begins as thoughts and emotions. And the more we're able to have power over those thoughts and emotions, the more we're able to create the world out there that we want. So it's creating the relationship with your inner processes such that you produce through intention and purpose the life that you want to have. And one of the key ways to get there is you have to be on top of your emotions. You can't be a victim of your emotions, that they come up and you can't do anything but act them out. Well, that's not true. And that's book number one. Book number two is a book about the deeper root causes of being triggered. Why do we get triggered? I sit in business meetings and topics will come up and one person gets angry, but other people don't. And then another topic come up, someone else would get angry and other people don't. How is it that it triggers one person and not another person? It has to be something inside that person. And what it is that everybody has deep-seated insecurity. So the second book is about looking deep within and healing those underlying limiting beliefs that everybody has buried deep down inside that are the real source of why we react. And these would be limiting beliefs. Mine, I'll tell you mine. Two of my most prominent ones. One is nobody loves me. Grew up in an environment where as a little boy, I drew a conclusion that I just wasn't lovable and that nobody loves me. Another one is I don't belong. And because of those two patterns, I created a lot of carnage in my life. I wrecked my first marriage. I was got some feedback early in my professional career that I would never be put in front of senior management because I was a loose cannon. And those were wake-up calls for me to do my own work. And that work has led to what I teach in my coaching. The third book is about Be Your True Self. And Richard, with the interviews that you've done, I know you've already engaged in these kinds of conversations. The difference between who we are as an ego and who we are at the level of your true self or your inner self or soul, whatever you want to call it, your higher self, that we come into this world whole and complete, and we have a set of qualities, and these are radiant qualities. These are amazing qualities that include your key characteristics, a life purpose, unique talent, things like that. And then as we go through life, we get wounded. We get told we're not enough. We draw conclusions that something's wrong with us or a number of things are wrong with us. And then most people live within those. And if you ask them to describe themselves, they'll put things like, yeah, well, I'm no good, or I'm a slacker, or they have these labels for themselves that they've been taught are true about them, and they are not true. They're simply labels that you've chosen to stick with, but we don't have to stick with them. And when we identify with who we truly are, and shed these layers of false beliefs, it's like taking the buttons out. You know what it means to have your button punched? You know, that's the equivalent of a trigger. It's like you remove the button, because with no insecurity, then you're not threatened. And a trigger means you're threatening me. My ego is feeling challenged. But if there's no threat, then there's no need for a reaction. And the result of that is peacefulness. And so learning who you are, for many people, just by itself is really liberating. And then learning the tools to be able to remove those deep triggers, which is book two, is what leads to a tremendous sense of peace, because you can walk through the world, navigate the world, and what used to upset you is just information now. It's just something happening.
Well, I've heard it said that there's the difference between acting and reacting.
Yes.
And the reacting, of course, is due to all the pre-programming that we've had done as we have been growing since we've come into this world.
Right.
Whereas the acting is you're the observer, if you will, taking that role.
Right.
And you are acting based upon more grounded, more centered, if you will, attributes of self, and not by every whim of emotion. And, you know, it can really make a huge difference when it comes to getting through life. I mean, I remember quite clearly when I went through my first divorce, and hopefully my last, my only, you know, I actually received divorce papers. They were delivered to my place of employment. I was served. By the way, I subsequently found out that, many people know of it as a divorce, but you're actually being sued. I did not know it was a lawsuit. I thought divorce was something totally different. But anyway, and I remember for the entire month, I was served on May 1st, okay, May 1st of 1998. And even that day, as emotional as I was over the whole thing, because it was a surprise to me at one extent, I was able to make the joke. I said, you know what, being served divorce papers at your place of employment gives a whole new meaning to the phrase Mayday. Okay, so I was able to actually make a joke. But for the entire month of May, I was nothing. I was in no other place but in my emotions.
Yeah.
And I went to see on the 14th of May, I went to see her attorney and she in his office. After going to an attorney whose slogan, which was wonderful, was reasonable solutions for reasonable people. Not the slogan of my ex-wife's attorney. Anyway, I proposed, I laid out a proposal for them, to them, that I thought was pretty darn reasonable. And of course, he says, oh, there is no way that a judge will ever approve that, blah, 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 blah. The irony is 9 months later, the very proposal that I had put before them was the very proposal they accepted, only now I was $3,600 in the hole. Mm-hmm. But I was in my emotions for the entire month of May. And I kept thinking, oh, my God, what are they going to do next? And what are they? And they have all the power. And I kid you not, I don't know what happened, what shifted exactly on June 1st. But I got out of my emotions and I started to think. I started to use my brain and I realized, wait a minute. There were two people involved in this relationship, not one. And yes, I have a certain level of responsibility, but so does she.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember an exchange of words between myself and my ex-wife at that time where she said, but you promised blah, 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 blah. And I basically said to her, I said, the moment you got an attorney, all the rules changed. So those promises that I made were null and void because she had gotten an attorney and was coming at me in a rather vicious manner. It's like we had no assets. We had a house. That was it. That's all we had. Mm-hmm. No stocks, no bonds, no gold, silver, no pensions, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's like, you know, I can fill out the 1040 EZ form. That's what we had, you know. And so I didn't understand why this was being dragged out. And anyway, so 1 month I was drowning. And then for some reason, and again, I wish I could remember the catalyst. Maybe I'll go into some therapy or something and have that brought up again. I came out of that. And I began to do the things that I knew I needed to do. But I also was still respectful of her, because there were three instances that I do remember during the process where I tried to be nice. I didn't want to be mean. Because I've always found this perplexing, Mark, in relationships. And I know this happens, but it's always still perplexing. Where individuals who go into a relationship and they're there for a period of a good period of time, and then something happens and they go their separate ways and they never see each other again. They never communicate. And yet after all the time that they spent together, there's nothing left. And that's always, and so I've managed, by the way, to try to stay in contact with her. Just to say, hey, you know, I never stopped caring. I just didn't like the process that we were going through. That was horrendous. But I never stopped caring. I wish it hadn't gone that way, but it did. And I'd like for us to at least be friends. And so at least we're at that level. But I've always used the phrase that I've never given up on anybody, and I'm not about to start, you know, even though we went through this 9-month or 8-month disaster, if you will. You know, I just have a hard time saying, you're out.
Well, I think you're recognizing there's a difference between who somebody really is and who they are when they're really upset and acting out. And what I'm hearing you say is you could see through that. Mm-hmm. You could see through the anger, the upset, the finger pointing that she was in, and remember who she really is. And kudos to you for that. Because a lot of people would. A lot of people would have just labeled that person ungenerously, and that would have been that. And so I want to pick up on something that you said and then illustrate it with that marvelous story, and that was this. You started out by saying you can act or you can react. And then you pointed out there was a point at which you were really in the emotions, and then somehow you shifted. And when you shifted, it's like you woke up. That's the label I would give to it. It may even have felt like, wow, what happened to me? And now I'm awake and I realize, wait a minute, I don't want to be angry. I want to be who I am, which is a kind, caring person who still cares for her. And I want to also advocate for myself from a logical place. That's what it feels like to do the pivot to power. And your example is an example that we could map to the small circumstances that every one of us experiences every day. And I would call the part of us that is able to act, I call that the pilot. And the part of us that is reacting, the autopilot. Because our emotions just happen. We don't stop. We don't stop and go, let me see here. Do I want to be angry? Do I want to be frustrated? Do I want to whine and be pathetic? What do I want to do here? We don't do that, Richard. We just act. Boom. We just react. And it happens. And it happens because our subconscious is running these programs. And the subconscious is the autopilot. And when you were able at the first of that month, I think you said it was June, when you were able to wake back up to who you really are, then you brought a much better version of yourself to everything you were doing. And that's the pivot to power. It's getting out of the autopilot driving and moving back into the pilot. And the pilot is the closest things we have to our experience of our true self, our awake, our conscious self. And the autopilot is everything we're programmed to do, every programmed reaction. And the only way to live a conscious life is to be able to stay in the pilot. And that's what I mean by mastering your emotions. It isn't that we control them. It's that we say, you don't get to drive. Yeah. You don't get to drive in my life. I'm the driver. You are a resource for me. And I'm going to use that resource effectively and appropriately. And I'm going to continue to live out of choice as who I am and who I'm intending to be. Like when you felt badly about that board on the chicken coop and you didn't want to tell your wife about it, it's because, Richard, you know who you are and you know that you're better than that.
Yes.
You know that there's a version of you that can and does handle things so much better than that. And all of us have that. And everyone knows that I can be better than I just was. Whether it's your kids that get under your skin and you yell at them, or you do something, you go, oh my God, that's, you know, their therapists are going to love me when they're adults. But we all want to be our best self. I really believe that the vast majority of people are aware that there's a version of them that is their best self, and they really want a way to be able to be that person. And that's part of my motivation, is part of what I'm aspiring to, and why I developed and use these tools myself, and definitely why I want to offer them to the world, is to help people have that, their version of what you experienced, waking up from being gripped by an emotional reaction that's going to cause damage.
Yeah, physical, mental, emotional, in a lot of different ways.
And every way there is, actually. And the research, in terms of physical, the research is unequivocal that the damage to our bodies for unprocessed, ineffectively processed emotions is one of the main reasons that we have the highest healthcare costs in the developed world and the poorest health in the developed world. Mm-hmm. And learning these tools is one of the key ways that you can then also be powerful and take responsibility for my health and how I'm going to be, and what my physical health is going to be in the world. So, you know, Richard, I really appreciate how you've been able to draw from your own experience stories that are stories everyone can relate to. You know, whether they've been divorced or not, they've certainly had a bad ending to a relationship.
Yeah.
And how did that feel to them, and what happened to them? I went through, I've gone through really, really ugly divorce. And even though I was knowledgeable about this and had done a lot of work, it was like trying to keep my head above water when I had weights tied to my ankles. There's certain circumstances that make that difficult. And that's to be expected. This work is not about being perfect. It's about improving. It's about every day becoming a better version of yourself and working to bring your best self to the circumstances where it's most needed, and that's when you're triggered. And that's exactly why I've named that technique Max the Moment. Maximize the moment when it's most needed. When those kids are under your skin, use the techniques to bring yourself back into center and then intervene with them like you did in the legal proceedings. In the most appropriate way, set boundaries, put them in time out, sit them down, calm them down, have them take a nap. All of that would be more productive than yelling at them.
Absolutely. Absolutely would be. I mean, I even go back and I take a look at, for example, my father and the way he raised us. And my father was no saint. He wasn't perfect. He had his foibles. And there were times when, you know, if I was to look back and say, well, you know, he was awful tough when, you know, with the belt, you know, and that kind of thing. But you know what? I have more memories of our times shared going on vacation and holidays and at the dinner table and so forth than I do any of that other stuff. And I'm not saying that I grew up in a Norman Rockwell painting, but it was pretty darn close. Because when people talk about, you know, that Thanksgiving dinner disaster of family drama and trauma, we didn't have that. Did we always get along? Of course not. But there was something in that household and in those relationships that holds us together even to this day. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, I have to say that as of the time of our conversation, I am very grateful for the fact that all five of my other siblings and my two parents are still very much alive, doing very well, very, I'm going to say, high quality of life, and are very happy with the lives they brought into this world. My parents are great grandparents. It makes me a great uncle. This is pretty wild. I have no kids. So I'd have to say that from that standpoint, from a family dynamic, I'm fortunate. I don't know if it was by design or what the deal is. I'm just very glad that it was that way. But I have to say, too, that it would be nice for all of us to be able to go wherever we wanted to go and do whatever it is that we wanted to do without fear of repercussion. And sometimes repercussion of just showing up. Mm-hmm. What are you doing here? You know, I don't care what you're doing. What are you doing here? You know, you have no business here. It isn't when, in fact, well, it's the library. I'm here to check out a book. Because, I mean, that's kind of where our society is today, isn't it? I'm going to share something with you really quickly because, to me, this is I'm curious. I'm a very curious individual, as you have, I'm sure, taken note of my interviews. Mm-hmm. I want to, and folks, I think I've said this on previous programs, I'm very curious about the Islamic faith, the true core of the Islamic faith. But damned if I'm going on the internet to do the research, because I don't want any red flags by the NSA coming after me. But I want, as much as I'm curious about the Hindu faith and the Jewish faith, as well as Christianity, which I was born and raised in, Taoism and Zen Buddhism and whatever other philosophy you want to throw up at me, I would like to know what that philosophy has to teach and what's available. But in our culture, in our society, and in the atmosphere in which we live today, you can't do that. Not unless you are really strong or you do it in secret. Your response?
Yeah, I'm just sitting with that for a second. I also am very curious, and I personally don't have concerns about the government looking me up. They can look me up all they want to. There isn't anything to find, you know. So, but I do believe absolutely that the more we know about each other, and especially from a non-judgmental perspective, that the more compassion we have. I actually was thinking about something you said earlier, Richard, and I'm wondering if we could go back to that, because I think you pointed out something that's really important for the listeners with regard to emotional health. I felt it in my body when you were talking about the pleasures of working in your property, of the smell of the grass and being outdoors and working with the land. So what I want to highlight is one of the ways that we can calm ourselves and generate some resilience to stressors is appreciation, acknowledging the things in life that we're grateful for. You used appreciation to stay out of a real toxic, destructive story about your father, even though, you know, you could have easily gone, well, you know, he was a really hard man, and, you know, with the way he disciplined us, and gone a different way. Lots of people do. And you didn't, because you were able to say, and I appreciate so many things about that relationship. Appreciation is something I teach my executive clients to do every day, all day long. And it's different than gratitude, which people tend to think of gratitude as something really big, and it's like associated when someone has done something special for us, like a special gift or something particularly thoughtful. But appreciation is noticing what makes me happy. And you were such a great model for what was making you happy. And when you're happy, your body releases this marvelous neurochemical called oxytocin. And oxytocin is called the love molecule. It's actually the chemical that is released when mothers give birth in massive quantities to help baby and mom bond together. But we all release oxytocin. And oxytocin has the effect of helping us feel open-hearted and generous and trusting and cooperative and like life is good. It also releases dopamine, which reinforces that feeling. So every time we notice what we appreciate, we get some oxytocin. And that oxytocin lasts 3 or 4 hours in our body. So the more that we're able to look around and be grateful, if you like coffee, that first cup of coffee in the morning, I love the taste of that coffee. I love getting in the shower and feeling the hot water just loosening my muscles. It's a wonderful feeling. I put a little peppermint oil in there, and the smell of the peppermint is awesome. I work out of a home office. I can look out back and I see the breeze blowing the limbs of the trees and the play of light through the trees and how beautiful it is, and the birds singing. Each of these small things, when I appreciate them, I'm building a feeling of well-being. And as I do this all day long, especially noticing the small things in life, the unspectacular things that are still great, that make life great, then life becomes sacred. Every day becomes a sacred, amazing experience. Like the whole world is lining up to create all these great feelings for us. And all we have to do is look for them.
Yeah.
And the chapter on mindfulness, I talk about that's one of the key things to do to help generate a sense of general well-being and reduce your stress, is focus on what you appreciate and notice it all day long.
Yeah. Matter of fact, at the time of our conversation here, I stepped out to get some lunch, took a little walk down our main street, State Street, and it's a little warmer than I would like it. Okay, I'm not a real fan of heat. Since I moved from Phoenix, Arizona, not a real fan, kids. But, you know, some days they're warmer than others. But instead of dwelling extensively on that, I decided, you know, it's a beautiful day. Some clouds in the sky. Everything right now is green. It's just gorgeous. And so I really focused on that more than the other elements of the heat and so forth, and it really made all the difference in the world. You know, I was still, it didn't mean I wasn't sweating a little bit, you know, under my hat and what have you, but you know, at least I could have a little bit more enjoyment of my time outside, which I try to get as much as I can. And I have to say, the one thing I love about living here, as I'm sure you do there, Mark, is the fact that I'm not sure how far you are from the beach, but when I love the fact that here I can 20 minutes and I can walk literally in 20 minutes down to the beach, as opposed to 20 days from Phoenix, you know. and it's you know, and it's a wonderful thing. And I know that many of my guests, as you have sort of alluded to, speak about one of the real keys to centering ourselves, in a manner of speaking, to of getting out of our emotional state, shifting, reconnect with nature. In whatever way that you can.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that can be as simple as even having a pet, a cat or a dog or a bird, and spending time with that creature.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. Hey, before we go any further, I want to let our listeners know that there are some websites I want you to be aware of for Mark and his work. And by the way, he's quite accomplished in addition to being a father and stepfather, and also a photographer, a singer-songwriter, and fine arts photographer, which maybe we'll chat on a little bit here. You can go to markyoungblood.photos, markyoungblood.photos in that regard. There's also the websites the one he referred to earlier, especially regarding his inner mastery work, is myinnermastery.com, myinnermastery.com. There is also Dear Human Books, which I'm going to guess is going to contain the multitude of chapters or volumes in this mastery series that you're putting together. DearHumanBooks.com. There's also MasterYourEmotionsBooks.com and InnerMasteryCommunity.com. I'm sure that in one way, shape, or another, Mark or his webmaster have linked all of these so that no matter where you go, you will not get lost. You will find what you're looking for, and we encourage you to investigate all of that as well. Interesting. You also have some previous books as well in regards to, I love some of these titles, Eating the Chocolate Elephant, Take Charge of Change, and Life at the Edge of Chaos, Creating the Quantum Organization. Now, you haven't written this one, but I'm going to throw in another book, and this kind of ties into what we've been talking about, I think. Many years ago when I was working for a Christian radio station, I was asked, it was sort of mandatory, to read a book, a particular book. And the title of the book was, let's see if I remember the title of the book. I think it was called Who Hid the Cheese, or Who Moved the Cheese.
Yeah, Who Moved the
Who
Cheese.
Who Moved the
right.
Cheese. Now, it wasn't a big book, so it wasn't a real horrendous thing. And so, you know, I said, okay, sure, all right, I will read it. And I read it. And I had to tell my boss after I read it, I says, look, I don't have a problem with somebody moving the cheese. I don't. My problem is you got to tell me that you're moving the cheese, okay? If you want to move it, you could move it to Bangladesh for all I care. Just tell me so that I know not to look for it here in Santa Barbara, okay? Mm. And I don't know, maybe I still have the same problem as the book was talking about. Mm. But I do have that challenge because I like things to be where they are so that I know when I go to look for them again, they're there. Mm. And sometimes, you know, and I know I'm not alone, I have people who... after doing something, they didn't apparently learn in kindergarten that when you're done with your toys, you put them back in a toy box. They would leave them somewhere else. And then I would, hey, where is the hammer? Or where is this cup? Or where is that tray? Or, well, it's over there. Well, yeah, but that's not, you know, it's not. And I never accuse them. Well, that's not where it's supposed to be. I don't go there. I say, well, okay, it was right there all the time. You didn't see it. I said, I didn't think to look there because that's not where I expect it to be. And I've joked with people and said, you know, I was looking for my phone the other day. And it wasn't in the last place I looked. I found it, but I kept looking. So there you go. That way I never have to say, oh, yeah, I found my phone. Did you find it in the last place you looked? I said, no. I found it, but I kept looking. It's like, okay. And we do that all the time. I mean, not literally, but I mean, there's a certain element of that as we go through our day, you know, because we get so lost in our emotions and they blind us to what's really in front of us.
Well, actually, our perceptual process blinds us as well, and that was another great lead-in to one of the key parts of this message. And people say, what do you mean you create your life from the inside out? You know, the life is the life. The world is the world. And I go, no, it's not. The world is invented in your head through our perception process, and it's quite literally a fantasy. It's a fantasy we make up based on what we observe and the stories we tell ourselves about what we've observed. So you and I seeing the same thing could potentially draw two completely different conclusions about it and be operating out of two different worlds. Your world would lead you to one set of behaviors and my world would lead me to another. And that is what you pointed out a while ago when you talked about the political factions that wished the other one simply didn't exist. It's because in their paradigm, there's one truth, and as if, you know, they had some sort of cosmic ability to declare that this is the only way to see something. It's the only way to be.
Yeah.
But because our perceptual system, because we take in data and we don't actually perceive everything there, Richard, I was kind of reading into what you were saying, something that I do all the time, is I will be looking for something and I'll go, sweetheart, where is so-and-so? And she'll walk over and it's about 6 inches from my hand. But it wasn't where it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And because it wasn't where it was supposed to be, I didn't even see it that was right there on the counter.
Mm.
And that's what our brain does. Our brain only sees what we expect to see. And so our brain has all these biases, confirmation bias, self-fulfilling prophecy. You were referring to self-fulfilling prophecy earlier where you were going, you know, they didn't take any responsibility at all for their role in creating it. That's exactly right, because I have a phrase that nobody dances alone.
Yeah.
But when we come to terms with the fact that our brain tries to make meaning out of things, but it's making it up out of cherry-picking certain data, telling a story, and then we take that story, and if we act like it's the truth, now we've set ourselves up to be really in conflict and upset and frustrated because it's only a map. It's not the real thing itself. Because it's made up, if we have a story that something is bad, we can make up a story that it's not bad. Like your choice to not see your father as a villain. I grew up, Richard, in Beaumont, Texas, down on the coast with a spare the rod, spoil the child parenting style. And he was an alcoholic. So he would rage and he would beat us and leave welts that we had for days. And I was terrified of him. And I grew up hating him. And it took a while for me to actually change that story so that I could be in relationship. And I did fairly early on, and I was able to really love him. But I easily could have stayed in a story that he was an absolute monster that didn't deserve one more minute of my time and completely cut off that relationship. Well, that's a story. And there's evidence to say, yeah, it's legitimate and it's justified. But I could just as easily make up a story. Well, he's a wounded guy too, and he doesn't have any more emotional mastery than almost anybody else. And it was all he could do. He was numbing himself with alcohol. He couldn't handle his anger, and so he acted it out on his kids. But that's not who he is. And the proof was that, just like you said, people are complex. They're not one thing. He put three boys through Eagle Scouts. He earned the Silver Beaver in Boy Scouts, which is one of the most prestigious awards you can earn. That he touched so many boys' lives as a scoutmaster that 60 years later they came to his funeral. He wasn't just one thing. We can make up any story we want. And the question I'm always asking is this an empowering story? Is this a story that generates love? Is it a story that generates healing? Does it create well-being in yourself and other people? Does it serve you? Does it serve life? And if it doesn't, make up a different story. Mm-hmm. You're making it up anyway.
Yeah.
And this is where it's called a reframe. You may have heard this term before. It comes out of neuro-linguistic programming, and I'm a master practitioner of that. And a reframe is when you change what something means, it changes the world.
Hmm. Interesting.
For you. It yeah. changes your world.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, first of all, I was in Scouts for 6 months. Lived next door to a family of scouts who moved it up. I went in, of course, as a tenderfoot. And 6 months later, I left as a tenderfoot. it's really interesting. Again, one of the things that we want to encourage people to do, and I think through your work, you're helping us to do that, there's an event that is taking place, and there's a circle around that event. And it is our responsibility as individuals to occupy as many points around and on that circle as we possibly can to get as broad a perspective of that event as we can.
Yes.
As you've, I'm sure, heard this before, that there can be a car accident and 10 people will have witnessed it. But you're going to get 10 different viewpoints of
that
accident. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to expand that as far as not only our lives, but the lives of the people around us. And by the way, one of the things that just occurred to me was, what if the one side said, gee, if the other side didn't exist, that would sure be great. Life would be so much better. What if your spouse or your children or even your parents were members of the other side. Would you really say that? I used to really get upset about gas prices, I used to ask the question rhetorically, would the oil barons, you know, would they charge their mothers these exorbitant prices? You know, probably they would, but I don't know. Maybe they have free gas cards. But it's like, it kind of goes back to the golden rule on all of this. Not just do unto others as you would have them do unto you, but I've modified it. Do unto others as if you were the others.
Yeah, I love what you're doing with this. I really love where you're going with it. And so someone else has a different worldview, or what I call a bias. Mm-hmm. It's really different than yours. And you're saying, walk around to their side.
Yeah.
Try to understand their story. And when you understand their story, your heart softens.
Yeah.
Because there's merit to their point of view. You may not agree with every conclusion that they've drawn about it, but if you don't even let their story in and you claim the big T truth as opposed to the little T truth, which is I have a personal truth about this based on how I see things, but there's room for other personal truths, and I respect that other people are seeing it different than me. And let me engage them in a way that I can understand where they're coming from. Whether I ultimately agree or not, I can respect their right to see it that way.
Yeah,
I think that was behind what you were saying earlier, where you go, I'm curious. I respect that all these different frames of reference, Islam, Buddhism, Judaism, whatever, you know, all these different perspectives, they've got merit. There's legitimacy to seeing it from that perspective. And when I broaden myself to take in that perspective, I'm expanded. I'm a bigger human being without giving up who I actually am at my core.
Well, James Redfield in his Celestine Prophecy made the comment in the book that we each have messages for one another. And I kind of expanded on that, saying, yes, that is true. And also that these messages help us as individuals, when we receive them, to build and continue putting together the pieces of our, shall we say, our jigsaw puzzle. So when we cut ourselves off from one another and from experience and so forth, then we are not only denying ourselves of that potential missing piece that could be crucial in a particular area of our lives, but we're also denying someone else the opportunity of continuing to work on and complete their puzzle.
Yes. When we're threatened by someone, we can ask the question, because we're really not in touch with it, we can ask the question, what is at risk if they're right? What am I afraid of, really? If they have some merit to their point of view, what's at risk for me?
Yeah.
And is it true that that's at risk? And often it isn't at risk. Another thing I'm hearing you point out is how important it is to preserve relationship, that we have to find a way to stay in relationship even though we have differences. It's like you're saying, would you really have your parents, your siblings, your maybe even, I know of husband and wife that are on opposite sides of the political spectrum. Would you really want them to disappear?
Yeah.
Can't, you know, let's find a way to be in and to stay in relationship. And Richard, I'm seeing as part of this most recent election, a lot of people starting to go, you know, I don't know a single person who voted for the other party. And that's on both sides of the spectrum. And they're realizing something's wrong with that.
Yeah.
And these bubbles that we're hearing about, there's a real danger with the kind of internet bubbles where people only are friends with people that say exactly what they say and see it the way they see it. Because when we talk about bias and we talk about making up a worldview, when everyone around you is saying the same things, you assume you're right.
Yeah.
Because you're not hearing anything contradictory. And when you do, they must be the devil.
Yeah. When I was working for the Christian radio station, and at that time in the 80s, there was a big brouhaha over the fact that the magazine Playboy was being published in Braille and paid for by taxpayer dollars. And I was talking with my then boss about this, and I said, okay, from strictly a business standpoint, I am in complete agreement. If Hefner wants to make Braille versions of Playboy available to the blind and visually impaired at the newsstand price, I say then he should do that. However, the current situation is that this magazine, which had at the time, and I don't know, I haven't seen a magazine lately, but had some great articles and so forth in it, as the joke always goes, oh, yeah, I got the magazine for the articles, and the blind did. And you're saying that you don't want taxpayer dollars to be spent to pay to have that continue from the Library of Congress. You are now telling a segment of our population that you, the sighted world, are going to tell them, the unsighted world, what they can and cannot read. You can go into any bookstore or library, skim the shelves based upon font size and type, color, pictures. You can take the book off the shelf, flip through it, see whatever you want to see and say, I like this or I don't like this. I'm going to buy it or I'm not going to buy it. The blind can't do that. You are basically telling them that you are going to determine their civil rights, their basic human right to choose what they want to read or listen to or who they can associate. I mean, that's the slippery slope that you're going down. And what was interesting in that whole, it wasn't so much the conversation per se, but the outcome of that conversation was he agreed with me. I actually made a cogent argument to a very staunch religious individual, and this only happened like once, my point was seen and heard. Mm-hmm. And I feel very strongly about people's right to choose, especially not just in terms of disability, but I'm talking in terms of this program, giving people choices and knowledge of those choices. You have a right to know what's out there. Mm-hmm. That's why I am saddened by the state of our educational system. And by the way, I have to say that no amount of money thrown at education is going to solve the problem. It isn't about money. It's mm-hmm. about choice. And if I want to get a religious education versus a political education versus an engineering or construction worker education or whatever direction I want to go, I should be able to get as much information as is available and it not be blocked from my ability to do so.
And that's a very strong belief system. You know, I can really hear the passion in your voice, the conviction you have. You've gathered information, you've drawn conclusions, you see the merit, the value of that. And then what happens when you meet up with someone who is just as adamantly convinced that, no, we have a responsibility to choose what people are able to see and hear?
Yeah. I mean, yes, there are features on our various devices today that will allow us to, you know, parental controls, that kind of thing. But yeah. That's a whole different thing in terms of if your children are using these devices and you want to activate the parental controls to prevent them from going places and seeing things that you really would not like them to see. That's a whole different realm from, Mark, I'm sorry, but I don't think that your book is, I don't think it's appropriate for the general public. So, you know, we'll put the interview up, but I'm not going to link because it's just too dangerous. It's heresy, Mark. It's heresy.
Right.
And that's sad. And that's really
sad.
See,
we do meet up with people like that. And we you know, it's part of our experience, whether it's this specific difference of opinion or it has to do with whether my fruit should be dropping on my neighbor's yard or not, and whether I have a responsibility to pick it up. We're always going to be faced with people whose worldview is going to be different. Mm-hmm. And I respect what you're saying. You and I happen to share the perspective that information is really important, and freedom of information as an adult to be able to make choices, and it tends to liberate the human spirit. You and I agree with that.
Yeah.
The point I want to make and draw it back to what happens in terms of emotional reactions and conflict is when someone strongly holds an opposing position, who are we going to be? what's going to happen in that circumstance? And what we've seen is that we're not handling it well.
Yeah.
We're making them the devil, or we're making them a villain, instead of respectfully saying, I appreciate that you see it that way. Maybe I ought to listen to you more and understand, what are you concerned about? What is it that has you feel as strongly in your opinion as I feel in mine? Because I don't get your bias. I don't understand your worldview. And until I do, I really can't draw any conclusions.
Yeah.
And we can't control whether they will or not return the favor and try to understand us better.
Yeah.
But our life is really about choosing who we're going to be, not trying to control who someone else is going to be.
Exactly, exactly. Well, I've always said that these interviews for me are like Christmas morning and opening up a present that I didn't sneak in the middle of the night sometime to open and look at it and then close it back up again. But I get to experience a whole new world, and in this case, Mark Youngblood's world, and what it is that he has to offer and what he's all about. And I share that with you folks who are listening, and I hope that you folks have been enlightened and educated, inspired, et cetera, et cetera. Mark, I want to thank you so much for taking so much time. I have to tell you that to date with Tell Me Your Story, this is now the longest interview that I have ever done, and I love the ability to be able to do these long forms. You know, I don't have the freedom on the radio broadcast, but on the, I guess I'm going to have to start using the phrase podcast, although it's more an archive. But anyway, to really extend the conversation, and I extend to you, first of all, that if you should find yourself out here on the West Coast and in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
Well, I would love that too, Richard. I've just really enjoyed getting to know you, and I love the style of your interviews where you reveal so much of yourself and really engage with this from a personal level. It's been a blast for me, and I appreciate the time today. I appreciate this opportunity.
MyInnerMastery.com is the website, MyInnerMastery.com. We encourage you to go to that site and find out more about Dear Human, Master Your Emotions, Volume 1 of the Inner Mastery Series, and we will have you back as you come out with 2 and 3 and so forth, and look forward to further discussions in these areas, because, again, I think it's fascinating, but I think it's also extremely necessary at this time in our history.
Thank you, Richard, and bless you.
And before I let you go, I have 3 final questions for you.
Okay.
And you've probably addressed them to some degree during the interview that we have conducted here. But I'll ask you pointedly, first of all, who is Mark Youngblood?
Well, that's a big question. How much time do you have? So the work I do and the person I'm being are pretty much the same thing, and that is, I'm a person who is committed to helping transform consciousness on the planet. And that's something I do for myself, and something I do as I engage with other people. My work is a combination of executive coaching and working with individuals through training on inner mastery, and it's all about how do you live a great life. I love creativity. I'm a photographer, as you said, and one of my great joys is to grab my cameras and go out and watch the sunsets over the ocean or over some of the shoreline views that we have in this area, and travel the world doing photography. If I come visit you, I'm bringing my camera.
Oh, you'll get some great shots.
Get out and get some great photos. Relationships are really important to me. I'm married to the love of my life. Rachel Tumim, she's an amazing, amazing woman, and really challenges me to be my best self every day. And it's everything I've wanted it to be. I'm a proud dad of 3 kids, and they're all amazing, and I love them very much. So I'm not sure what else to do to develop that profile out.
Well, we'll just move on to the second question, and that is, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Yeah, I just pointed to that. everything I'm doing is designed to help transform consciousness, to raise the consciousness on the planet. And what I mean by that is when we operate out of a higher consciousness, we're engaging in behaviors and interactions in a way that is healthy and supportive and healing and is generally based in love and wisdom. And this world is crying out for it. There's so much suffering, so much conflict, and all of it is unnecessary. The way out of that pain and suffering is so readily available. And if you just have, if you just understand yourself and other people better, if you simply had a few simple tools like the drain the pain, it would almost overnight change your life for the better and create healed relationships and the ability to be joyful and bring your best self out to the world more and more and more. And my commitment is to take it as far and wide as I can. And this new business line of business, Inner Mastery Community, is an online learning community where all the training on these three books and much, much more than those three books will be out there for people to come join in a community. It'll be a monthly subscription experience where they can go through, you know, module after module, and moving ever more complexity up the chain of developing your consciousness, and really reach tens of thousands, ultimately, hopefully, hundreds of thousands of people around the world with the ability to transform their lives.
And final question for you, and I've read this in your book, so I'm curious just to see how well it matches up. Final question. What is your life's purpose?
Helping transform consciousness individually and collectively.
Mark Youngblood, thank you again so much for the time that you've shared with us, and we do look forward to continuing conversations here on the program, and much success and many blessings to you.
Same to you. Thank you very much, Richard.
And just a reminder that the book's available through Amazon and all the usual outlets, as well as his website, so please check out Mark Youngblood and his work on the Inner Mastery series. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal. And just a reminder that the book's available through Amazon and all the usual outlets, as well as his website. So please check out Mark Youngblood and his work on the Inner Mastery series.